You're listening to DTFHN for March 24th, 2026. I'm your Null Hypothesis host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where often better than the links. Something about this week has everyone asking whether what they own is actually theirs. Let's find out. They cataloged every escape route and closed them one by one. The ubypassino command, the bypass arrow registry toggle, the MSCXH local only trip, the fake email method. Each one was a way to set up Windows 11 without a Microsoft account. A way to own your machine without tying your identity to Microsoft from first boot. By October 2025, every single one was gone. A Microsoft engineer described it plainly. They were removing known mechanisms for creating a local account in the Windows setup experience. Not a bug fix. Deliberate policy. Think about coral reef bleaching. The water gets warmer. Not catastrophically, incrementally. Each degree of change is survivable. The reef adapts, or tries to. By the time the system collapses, there's no single moment you can point to. Just accumulated drift, and then absence. That's what Microsoft has been doing to Windows for 4 years. Not one dramatic heist. Incremental capture. Ads in the recommended section. A Copilot icon that hijacked WinFilet C and couldn't be moved. OneDrive silently enabling folder backup with no consent dialog. Your desktop and documents migrating to their cloud without a prompt. One user went viral describing how his files had simply vanished from his local drive because OneDrive had claimed them. Not a glitch. Architecture. Now there's a 7-point plan. The tech press is calling it a redemption arc. The fix addresses Copilot clutter. It promises fewer ads, fewer in an operating system retailing at $139. It does not address the local account requirement. It does not address OneDrive's quiet ownership transfer. It does not address the fundamental question of who your Windows installation actually reports to. Here's the thing about reef bleaching. It's reversible if you act early enough. What Microsoft has built is an operating system architecturally designed to extract your identity, your files, your browsing, your usage pattern, all routed into a profile they control. 7 points of cleanup don't change the underlying extraction model. The plumbing is still there. Linux desktop adoption keeps climbing. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. And when a company tells you the operating system you paid for will now have fewer ads, the correct response is to run the numbers on what switching actually costs. Because that cost is dropping every year. 30 years of stories today, and we are just getting started. Story 2. What makes a tool itself? Is it the name, the code, the people who built it, or the purpose it served? Opera turns 30 this year, and they've marked it with webrewind.com. An interactive time capsule that lets you move through the web as it looked from 1996 onward. Spinning cassettes, era-appropriate typography. A genuine attempt to surface what the early web felt like before the consolidation. And it does feel like something. There's a version of this story that's straightforwardly touching. The early Opera browser was a genuine act of engineering ambition. It fit on a floppy disk and ran on machines that Firefox would have laughed at. It shipped mouse gestures before anyone had a name for them. Tab browsing, speed dial, a built-in mail client. Opera wasn't following browser development. It was leading it. Users in the late 90s who found it came away changed. The comment sections for this story are full of people who remember exactly when they switched. exactly how long it took to adjust when they eventually left. That matters. That's a real legacy worth examining. But the engineering question you have to ask about any system is, who controls it now and what are they optimizing for? The company running Opera today is not the company that built Opera. It was acquired in 2016 by a Chinese consortium. What followed wasn't just a change in ownership. It was a change in mission. The browser became secondary. The primary product became high-interest mobile lending apps in African markets, operating under names like Ocash and Opesa, with APRs that would make a payday lender blush. This is documented. The apps have been pulled and relaunched and renamed. The webrewind.com campaign is genuinely beautiful work. The nostalgia it evokes is real. The browser, it's celebrating. The curious, ambitious, technically fearless browser. That existed. The entity funding the celebration has a different objective function now. This is why architecture matters beyond the code. When a tool passes through ownership, the values embedded in it don't transfer automatically. Open source projects survive their founders because the source survives. Proprietary systems carry the mission of whoever holds the keys at the moment. Opera's first 30 years contain something worth honoring. Just be precise about which era you're honoring and who's asking you to remember it. Moving on, someone solved a different kind of ownership problem. Not corporate, just residential. Story 3. The fundamental problem is simple. An electromechanical relay. When the gate controller receives a specific DTMF tone, it closes a circuit. That circuit releases the latch. The gate opens. Everything else in that box, the cellular router, the phone lines, the intercom handset, exists only to deliver a signal to that relay. When management let the cellular service lapse, they removed the delivery mechanism. The relay was still there. The circuit was still waiting. The gate had everything it needed except a signal. When the team opened the junction box, they found the expected layers of security theater. A router with admin credentials printed on its chassis. SSH access protected by a root password stored in a downloadable configuration file. The kind of oversight that suggests the threat model was people probably won't look. Phone line terminals accessible from an unlocked enclosure at face height. The first approach. Router takeover. Stalled on the custom serial protocol between the router and the control box. Cracking the router was straightforward. Understanding what to say to the gate controller in its own language, without documentation, without a debugger, was a vacation's worth of work they weren't willing to spend. The second approach. Injecting DTMF tones directly required knowing when the controller was listening. A gate that accepted phone commands at arbitrary times would be a different kind of vulnerability. The third approach was the correct one, because it started from what the system actually needed. A contact closure at the relay. Bypass the entire delivery chain. Wire a microcontroller across the relay terminals. Connect it to HomeKit. When Frank approves an entry request from his phone, the microcontroller closes the circuit for the duration the gate expects. The gate opens. The attack surface was always the relay, the cellular radio, the router credentials, the SSH service. Interesting detours. The solution required only understanding what the controller is actually doing, waiting for a contact closure. The comment thread is full of people who solved the same problem independently. ESP startup boards, reverse engineered protocols, repurposed landlines, and documented their solutions precisely enough to reproduce. That's the knowledge commons working correctly. Someone's specific fix becomes everyone's available answer. The box was never as locked as it appeared. What's better than one person documenting their fix? A tool built to make logs readable for everyone. Story 4. The first time I watched a log directory accumulate faster than I could read it, I had this realization that the system I'd built was now the problem I was trying to solve. Circular, yes. Funny, in retrospect. At the time, just sitting there watching files roll by, squinting at timestamps, gripping for keywords I knew mattered, increasingly certain I was missing the thing that mattered most. The historical echo. Ken Thompson wrote grep in a single night in 1973. The occasion was a request from his Bell Labs colleague Doug McElroy, who wanted to search through a corpus of text. Thompson pulled the pattern matching engine out of aid, wrapped it in a standalone tool, and handed it over before morning. The name came from the ED command. Gervosir Piet. Global regular expression, print, one night, one tool, half a century of daily use. The reason grep got written is the same reason LOV exists. Output accumulates faster than human attention can track it. This is a law, not a trend. Systems generate records of their own behavior because we need accountability. And then the records immediately become their own accountability problem. Log File Navigator has been around since September 2009. First commit, stack on GitHub, 15 plus years of quiet maintenance. It does the things you'd otherwise have to script together yourself. Auto detects file formats, decompresses on the fly, lets you query with SQL, follows multiple files simultaneously, previews filter operations before you commit them. The EV charger engineer in the comments, who spent a professional stretch staring at thousands of log files before finding them. That's the canonical user, not unusual. Normal, the SSH demo endpoint is a good touch. SSH playground at demo.lnav.org. Try before you install. That's consideration for the user's time, which is rarer than it should be. The comedy of this whole domain is that we generate logs to understand our systems, then build systems to understand our logs, which generate their own logs. Which? You see where this goes. Thompson saw it in 1973 and wrote something in one night we're still using. The maintainer of Lenov saw it in 2009 and built something people are still discovering. The tools exist. They've been accumulating for 50 years. Open, forkable, free. The only thing left is finding them before you're already drowning. Now, story 5. We've been looking backward at what 50 years of tooling left us. This one looks forward. What happens when the AI can finally see its own work? There's a moment in 1963 that changed how software gets built. MIT's compatible time-sharing system went live, and for the first time, programmers could see the computer's response as it happened. Before that, you submitted punch cards, walked away, came back hours later to a printout. The feedback loop was measured in days. The engineers who built CTSS understood something fundamental. A programmer who cannot observe their work in real time isn't programming. They're guessing, and then waiting to find out how wrong the guess was. That loop has been closing ever since. Interactive terminals, live debuggers, hot reload, browser dev tools. 50 years of tooling built around one principle. Visibility is correctness. You have to see what you're building, or you don't actually know what you built. Now run this forward. The agent writes the code, starts the server, reads the DOM, checks the console, declares done, but it never opened the browser. It never looked. The question sitting in the middle of every AI-generated UI pull request, the one nobody is forcing themselves to answer, what does done mean for a system that has never seen the thing it built? Proofshot is the answer, and it's elegant in the way that well-scoped tools usually are. Three commands. Proofshot start wraps your dev server and opens headless Chromium, capturing everything. Proofshot exec gives the agent a working vocabulary for the live UI. Navigate, click, fill, screenshot, scroll, proofshot, stop, trims, idle time. Collects console errors, runs pattern matching against server logs across JavaScript, Python, Go, Rust, and more. Then generates a proof bundle. Video screenshots, an interactive timeline, a summary.md ready to paste into the pull request. The engineering here deserves a close look. The synchronized video and action timeline. Not just a log file, but a replay where every agent action maps to a precise moment in the recording. The error detection that looks beyond the browser, console into server output. The standalone HTML viewer that ships everything self-contained. No external dependencies to load. This is considered design. Someone thought hard about what reviewers actually need. One commenter flagged the obvious extension. Desktop applications with no DOM, no accessibility tree. A drawing tool, a graphics editor. Where visual verification is the only verification available, that's where this approach earns its keep most completely. MIT license. The source is there. The feedback loop that CTSS started closing in 1963. We are still closing it. Every new layer of abstraction creates new blind spots. Proofshot patches one of the newest ones. That's the work. And it's good work. Today's theme is quietly revealing itself. What is tools that close the gap between what computers promise and what they actually deliver? Story 6 is a classic. The honest case against RipGrep goes like this. Grep already exists. It has existed since 1974. It runs on everything from a Linux supercluster to a 300 MHz Irix Octane. And someone proved that last part over the weekend. Incidentally, the POSIX standard is gospel. The muscle memory of 1,000 sysadmins is encoded in grape R. Why introduce another binary, another man page, another thing to install for what amounts to a speed improvement on a task that already worked? That argument deserves respect. And then you run it forward. Imagine you're searching a large code base 100 times a day, not hypothetically. This is what a working programmer actually does. Each search takes 3 seconds instead of one. That's 200 extra seconds a day. Spread across a team. Across a year. Now imagine the slower tool also ignores your gitignore, crawls into node modules, surface searches binary files, and returns noise you have to filter manually. The argument for good enough stops being a case for discipline. It becomes a case for learned helplessness, dressed up as pragmatism. Andrew Gallant built RipGrep in Rust and published this benchmark in 2016, 25 comparisons. Single files, directory trees, Unicode-heavy content, regex edge cases. The results weren't claws, and RipGrep wasn't just faster. There was more correct. Unicode support that doesn't cost you 300 milliseconds. Gitignore handling that actually works. Unlike the half implementations in every competing tool claiming to provide the same thing. The comments years later are a kind of receipt. Someone ported it to Irix. Someone notes, with detectable amusement, that RipGrep was already written in Rust before that became the obvious answer to everything. Someone else lifted the least common byte optimization for their own search tool. That last one is the whole point. Good ideas propagate when the source is open and the documentation is honest about how it works. The bemusing part is the original friction, new binary, unfamiliar flags, benchmark theater, they called it. But tools that genuinely improve the feedback loop don't require evangelism. They get adopted because the gap between using them and not using them is something you feel in your hands every day. RipGrip is now the default search backend in VS Code. The answer to 100 Stack Overflow questions that used to say, just use grip. The strongest argument against it was inertia. Inertia lost. Moving on. 13 out of 42. That's the commit rate on this experiment. 31% of the changes made the cut. 29 were reverted. The agent ran an experiment, measured the result, decided it was worse, and threw it away. Which sounds obvious till you sit with it. The system is running the scientific method. Not simulating it. Running it. The setup is deceptively minimal. A training script. A program file with research phases. A scratch pad where the agent writes down what it tried and what it learned. That last file is the one worth lingering on. Not the model architecture, not the EVL metric, the scratch pad, because what you're looking at is an agent that maintains a research log, updates it after each experiment, and uses it to decide what to try next. Memory plus iteration plus evaluation. That's the loop. Carpathy's original framing was constrained optimization with an LLM in the middle. The author tightened the constraints deliberately. 5-minute training, runs locked permissions, no direct Python execution, no network access during experiments. And this is the elegant part. The constraints aren't limitations, they're the design. Short experiments prevent the agent from overfitting to noise. Permission lockdown means the agent can only do the one thing it's supposed to do. The container isn't a cage. It's a focus mechanism. Someone thought carefully about what happens when you remove all the ways an agent can go sideways, and what's left is a system that actually works. Run this forward. If the loop is tight enough, and the eval metric honest enough, and the phases clear enough, the human's job reduces to writing program.md and going do laundry. That's exactly what happened here. By the time groceries were done, the agent had burned through 24 experiments and knocked a significant chunk off the mean rank. The author came back to nudge it. The agent had already done the work. The HN thread notes, this isn't novel in isolation. Big players have more sophisticated versions. Fair. What's different is the surface area. A single markdown file as the research agenda. The scratch pad as working memory. A commit revert loop as the journal of REH. Chord. The craft here is compression. Someone figured out what the minimum viable research loop looks like. Built exactly that and went to fold some laundry. 31% commit rate, 69% revert rate. That's not failure. That's science. Moving on. One commenter in the thread posed the question that reframes the entire discussion, whether reactivity itself. Not React specifically, but the whole paradigm of UI automatically responding to state changes. Was the original sin that produced modern front-end complexity? That's a serious question. Quite.js is implicitly a serious answer. The framework does something that sounds trivial until you think there about what's been lost. It treats the DOM as the source of truth. No virtual DOM. No reconciliation pass. No shadow copy of your interface living in memory. diffing itself against reality. You write HTML. You attach behavior. The browser, which has been doing DOM work longer than most front-end developers have been alive, does the rest. This matters beyond ergonomics. The build pipeline that became standard in modern front-end development isn't just a technical choice, it's a gate. You need Node installed. You need NPM. You need to understand dependency resolution and bundler configuration, and the particular failure modes of whatever toolchain you've inherited. That's a meaningful barrier to entry. A junior developer, a hobbyist, someone in a context where running a local dev server is genuinely difficult. They're not locked out by capability, they're locked out by infrastructure. Kit.js is one repository. Git submodule it or copy it. Include a GonzaScript tag. Write components in plain JavaScript. The knowledge required is HTML and JavaScript. Which is to say, the foundational knowledge the entire web is built on. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. This framework doesn't add new prerequisites. It removes them. Another commenter suggested the tagline was wrong. That leading with hate frames the project as a reaction rather than a proposition. That's fair. What Qt is actually offering isn't a protest vote. It's a claim about where the complexity went and what it cost. The declarative state model, the parent decides, child emits hierarchy, the structured fields and flags separation. These are real architectural ideas that deserve evaluation on their merits. The honest version of the pitch is this. If you're building something where the browser's native capabilities are sufficient, and you're being asked to justify a 1,000 package dependency tree to accomplish it, Qt asks whether that complexity was ever yours to carry in the first place. For a real segment of real project. Internal tools, content sites, apps where a build pipeline is overhead without return. The answer is no. Someone built a shorter ladder and left it where people can reach it. What happens when you strip complexity from hardware the way Kate stripped it from the web? Story 9 has an answer. 9 instructions. That's the entire ISA of the Raspberry Pi's PIO coprocessor. 9. When Bunny Huang built a spec-compliant FPGA clone. Regression tested. Cornered cases found and fixed. It consumed 39,087 logic cells. The RISC, 4 processors sitting beside it, 4,600. The PIO used more than half the chip and cut the maximum achievable clock rate from 100 MHz to 50 MHz. The devil's advocate case writes itself. Complexity concentrated is complexity earned. 9 instructions that each do the work of 50. Configurable side effects, barrel shifts. Automatic FIFO management. Program counter-wrap baked directly into execution. That's not bloat, that's distillation. You can implement SPI in 3 lines. An IDO peripheral that fits in your head. 1 instruction doing the work of 50 sounds like the win. The timing analysis disagrees. Each of those 9 instructions isn't one instruction. It's a combinational path. Barrel shift a 32-bit register. Check a threshold, conditionally wrap the program counter. Handle FIFO state. All settling within a single clock cycle. The logic has to cascade through all of that before the clock edge arrives. The PIO's critical path runs 2 BIOS longer than the VEX resides. The CISC argument wins on instruction count and loses on silicon. Exactly the trade-off that computer architects argued about in the 1980s. Now surfacing in an I/O coprocessor designed for hardware makers in 2026. The consolidation that looks elegant on paper costs cycles at runtime. Bunny's BIO takes the lesson. 14,597 cells, not 39,000. A more orthogonal instruction set, built from the PIO's own failure modes outward. Same fundamental promise, deterministic I/O, timing cycle accurate, GPIO control. The ability to offload anything timing critical from a CPU that was never designed for it. Less than half the resource cost, and better timing closure at higher clock rates. The method is worth naming. Bunny didn't start by designing something new. He built a careful copy first, forked an existing implementation, found every under-documented corner case, understood precisely where the complexity lived before touching the architecture. The GitHub repo is public. The full analysis is in the write-up. Bunny put the work where anyone can reach it. The crowdfunding campaign lists global instability as the primary risk to delivery. The engineering is done. The supply chain is mapped. What's uncertain is the world the package has to travel through. One commenter called that observation truly of our time. Hard to disagree. Moving on. What does it mean when a number is technically accurate and functionally misleading at the same time? The headline says iPhone 17 Pro running a 400 billion parameter model. A commenter immediately fires back. This behaves more like a 17 billion parameter model. Both are correct. Qwen 3.5397B is a mixture of experts' architecture. The weights exist, all 397 billion of them, spread across SSD and memory, streamed to the GPU on demand via a method Apple described in a 2023 paper called LLM in a Flash. But at any given inference step, only a small fraction of those weights are active. The model has 400 billion parameters, the same way a library has every book on its shelf. Most of them are standing perfectly still in the dark. The analogy I keep returning to is the orchestra. A symphony orchestra employs 120 musicians. During the oboe solo, you're hearing four. The rest are sitting quietly with their instruments in their laps. You could headline it, 120 musician, orchestra performs tonight. You wouldn't technically be wrong, you'd just be describing the headcount, not the music. The person who originally tweeted this was genuinely astonished. How? I'm running a 27B on my Mac with 64 GB of RAM and it's about to die. That's the deadpan punchline of the entire story. The answer involves SSD streaming, aggressive quantization, and Apple's unified memory architecture doing things discrete GPUs simply can't replicate at this thermal envelope. Clever engineering stacked on clever engineering. And somehow your phone handles it without catching fire, unlike the M2 iPad Air, which reportedly goes ridiculously hot within seconds under low. The honest version of this story is more interesting than the inflated one. Mixture of experts lets you build models with enormous theoretical parameter counts while keeping inference costs tied to the active subset. The question isn't whether 400B is real. It's whether the routing architecture can do things a dense 17B can't. Sometimes it can. Sometimes the routing is where the intelligence actually lives. One commenter cut to the conclusion directly. To the extent this whole movement reaches a stable endpoint, it's probably open source models running on your own hardware, good enough for 95% of use cases. The tools exist, the knowledge is available, the phone in your pocket might be closer to the endgame than any headline is currently willing to admit. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 24th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. voiced by Claude Opus 3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that belongs to you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.